Welcome to Overcritical, a show where we take a deep dive into movies, TV, and video games from a critical leftist perspective. Today we have a very special guest episode. We are joined by Red Media's Elena Ortiz and Sheng Manitou. They are hosts of various podcasts in the Red Media Network, such as Red Power Outer, Yoded, which are both excellent. Go check those out. But today, they are here with me to talk about the Taylor Sheridan media empire, including such fabulous hits like Yellowstone, 1883, and so on. So welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us on. This is, I'm glad to be, I don't know if I'm glad to be talking about it, but it's a little polite, but
yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things, just like Yellowstone in 1883, where like they're competently made shows from a technical perspective, but if you even take a cursory look at the writing, see a lot of those problems start to pop up, a lot of familiar tropes that just cannot seem to die, including Kevin Costner, who has been a thorn in the indigenous community's side ever since Dances with Wolves, but we'll get into that later. So I guess what I'll start with by asking you both is what has your exposure to these shows, some of Sheridan's movies like Wind River or Hell or High Water, what have been your thoughts on that sort of stuff up until this point, when we all started watching Yellowstone in preparation for this episode?
I remember watching Wind River and it, you know, wanting to see it because it was touching on murder and missing Indigenous women. And it, from the trailers and from what I had read, was actually on point in terms of the man camps and the extractive industries. And what I found in that movie was just a lot of violence porn and again, the white savior, the Indigenous characters being relegated to minor roles, background dressing, and really stereotyped, you know, roles in the background at, you know, nothing of any substance. The only Native characters you saw were really background. And the violence was really disturbing because instead of actually addressing the issue of missing and murdered Indigenous women, it was all, you know, a gangbang porn scene. And it was like, whoa, this is really disturbing. I had not seen Hell or High Water. I watched it in preparation for this. And, you know, again, you've got a great Indigenous actor who is relegated to the Tonto role and really made fun of and, you know, makes fun of himself, which I would have found somewhat tolerable if it hadn't been started by the Lone Ranger himself. I mean, the whole humor was actually brought in. And that movie was also super disturbing to me. Yellowstone, I started watching because I thought it was going to have some decent Indigenous characters in it, and it doesn't. It's like watching a train wreck. Like, I keep coming back for it because it's almost like so horrific that it's amusing. And I would like to focus on Beth and the character of Beth, because there's some seriously messed up stuff going on with the character, Kevin Costner's daughter. And then, because that was such a train wreck, I had to torture myself further by watching 1883, which was so bizarre. And again, you've got this blonde female character, and it seems like Taylor Sheridan focuses on this, like this, his idea of women and female characters is so fucked up that mm-hmm. it's not even like in the realm of reality. And you have in both these shows, you have these blonde women who are so damaged and so, you know, messed up that that their how they present is disturbing, and how they are defined by the male characters is equally disturbing. Like, they don't have any personality or any character of their own. Everything is defined by their relationship to the male characters. I don't want to start that right now. I should wanted to should throw in his two cents
there. But 1883's bizarreness, the way you bring it up, it really just like it kind of reminds me of that Western trope of damsel in distress, and like but it's like updated, right, for a modern age. And even then, like murder porn, you know, that's a good description for like what these kind of films portray, especially with trying to like, they're making a political message, right? So when you said the writing's not very good, it's pretty good if it's trying to develop a progressive right-wing narrative, right? Like a fantasy for yes. them to operate on, much like QAnon, but using the Westerners, which is, you know, I mean, the original QAnon, you can look at how a lot of the 7th Cavalry ended up in South Dakota being yellow journalism by the Hearst and Globe, who also started the Spanish-American War. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of, you know, super weird connections with this, because I started to ask myself, well, you know, who produced this movie? Who produced this? Paramount, right? But like, I was like, well, who at Paramount? And so I ended up figuring out that this is connected. This was the only project Weinstein sold to Paramount after the company went belly up. And so the producer's name is Glosner. I forget his first name. I don't know. It's somewhere in my notes. But, you know, he's like one of the other main producers along with Sheridan. And he's one of Weinstein's friends carrying over, you know, the money into this project. And it's the only project Paramount picked up from them. And what's worse is, as you go into most of these producers, they all have these weird, like, right-wing films. So, like, this guy, Glosner, he's related to this Waco film that's based on a Fed book and then a cult apologist who survived the incident, which there's one good review I saw while looking on Goodreads of this, you know, this guy's stuff, and he was like, oh, I urge everybody to be kind of sympathetic about these people, and refuses to call them a cult, and has this blog called The Victims of the Ghosts of November or something like that. It's a pretty good name, not gonna lie. But it's about Waco and Jonestown, which he was at both as part of the people who recovered the bodies. It's like, what the fuck? Excuse me, I don't know if I can swear, but
don't worry.
But you know, like it was just like one of the more crazy connections that I found in this, is that Jonestown can be like wrapped into it. And then this other guy's is it's this Rest in Power film about Trayvon Martin that is copaganda, you know. It's plays a lot of apologia for Zimmerman, know, and misrepresents the story. So what we're seeing here is there's a tendency amongst these producers to produce films that push, I don't know what it is, but it's right-wing reactionary, okay? I don't know what to mm-hmm. call it, really, but it's definitely not something I like to see pushed, because how long before the right wing adapts this into their narratives? Because imagine how many senators were influenced by their viewing of Longmire or this mm-hmm. like, you know, 1883 or Yellowstone in the decision with Oak Flat. You know what I mean? The idea that reservations are this lawless wasteland, therefore states should be able to assume more jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the interesting thing too in Yellowstone, and so I mean, when I look at them, when I look at 1883 and Yellowstone, it's just settler nostalgia. Mm. It's this idea of going back to the West and the times when life was simple, right? So you mm-hmm. knew who your enemies were, and it's a very hyper masculine image of men. And so when you swing that far to the right and that far into this toxic masculinity, therefore the female characters also swing. So the pendulum swings both ways. So you have this settler nostalgia and this idea of the time when America was great, right? So the time when westward, like 1883, westward expansion, they're making it, their ultimate goal was to go to Oregon. And with it, they're defining the West through a settler narrative. So everything in 1883, all the narration in 1883 is about how dangerous the land is and how it's going to kill them. And it's beautiful, but it's dangerous. And I got so sick of hearing that, because the rivers are not dangerous and the land is not dangerous. The snakes and tornadoes are not dangerous. It's putting human beings into areas where they might not necessarily should be that makes it dangerous. And of course, it follows that if the land itself is dangerous, that the people who inhabit that land, the indigenous people who inhabit that land, mm-hmm. are also dangerous. So it reinforces this idea that indigenous people are dangerous and to be feared, and they will come and take your women, because they did mm-hmm. it in 1883, although she was, no, I can't remember her name.
Elsa.
Elsa, thank you. Elsa was pretty fucked up herself. I mean, this is a woman who whose sexuality is like in your face. You see her from the very beginning getting off the train, like attracting attention, and you don't know how old she is. So you're thinking mm-hmm. she's maybe in her late teens, early 20s, and she ends up, you know, basically shedding this childhood, this image of this young girl, almost immediately upon getting, you know, on this wagon train. And she ends up actually marrying, or sort of marrying, I don't know, twice. But there's something very disturbing about her finding this sexuality. Like, it is almost, she becomes part of the land that is ready to be raped by the male settlers. And as a result, she literally is. She's penetrated. I'm getting ahead of myself, but she's penetrated by arrows. The arrows make her sick. She dies. And she wants to become part of the landscape, which actually she really is all along, because she's representing this virgin landscape that the settlers are going to destroy. And the character of Beth Dutton is equally disturbing on so many levels, in that she wanted to, may not, if you haven't watched the whole damn thing.
General spoiler warning for our listeners.
The whole episode, all of the episodes, seasons are out. So if you haven't watched them, sorry, I'm going to spoil it for you. But you find out the reason why Beth Dutton cannot have children is because she went to have an abortion, and her brother, while she was out under anesthesia, her brother gave permission for them to sterilize her. And so this is a blonde woman from a very wealthy, powerful family, and she is sterilized against her will. Now, we all know who got sterilized against their will, and it was not wealthy white women from good families. Yeah. And so that was really a horrific scene. You know, I watched that and I shook my head. I was just like, that's fucked up. And then her brother is married to a Native woman who, and on another scene, another really fascinating scene, who finds herself in a very high-end clothing store and is accused of theft because she's brown. She's shopping while brown. And she calls her sister-in-law. She calls Beth Dutton, who's this, like, you know, Tasmanian devil who just zips in and destroys the store. And she, it's fine because she has the money to pay for it. But, like, what would happen to an indigenous woman in a town in Montana if she was accused of theft? So there's white saviorism, and there's a lot of flipping of actual historical experiences in Yellowstone. And it's one of the things that is really super disturbing. The Kevin Costner, John Dutton, and his faithful right-hand dude, whenever they have to kill someone, because they have to kill a lot of people, like, there are bad people.
In the first episode.
So many. Well, first off, it doesn't take very long to kill a native, huh? But,
yeah. Oh, my God.
First episode. Anyway.
And they have this place they throw them. There's, like, this place they pull off the side of the road, and they throw these bodies. Like, right. Multiple bodies.
That's what I mean. Like, I feel like a lot of that's playing off of some of, like, the... So, like, if you've ever read America Indian Mafia by Trumbull, he's a FBI director. But, like, he makes the argument that the America Indian movement was a lot like a mafia. So I feel like they've taken a lot of narratives from that are catchy, right? And then turned them into, like, this other script to, like, make sure you don't think of the native incident of it, right? And, like, how many people are reading American Indian Mafia anymore? You know, it's a pretty old book at this point. So,
but yeah, that was one of the things.
I was just gonna say,
sorry, go ahead.
If you look at, like, some of the other, like, movies, like, what's his face Sheridan's involved with, it's like, well, and, like, just films and stuff, NCIS, Sons of Anarchy, like, the resume is just there's this, like, strong 12 strong, where he plays this freaking one dude that in a special ops force in Afghanistan. So it's all freaking propaganda movies. It's freaking it's weird.
That was one thing that struck me from the outset of the very first episode, that, like, this is a short this is a show, Yellowstone. It's another entry into the genre of, like, prestige TV dramas that follow a character or a family that are involved in some sort of crime or, like, just shady business. Like, we've seen it from Succession to Breaking Bad, The Sopranos. But this is different because the crimes that are... main characters are dealing with, like, it's not just like running a mob in New York or making meth to fund your cancer treatment. Like, this is stuff that has huge racial history behind it. The first thing that they do in the first episode is cover up what Casey Dutton did, which was essentially execute this indigenous character. I can't remember his name, but, like, he unequivocally murdered this person. Like, he is, like, completely guilty of it. We see it on screen. There's no ambiguity, but John Dutton gets that whole ball rolling of calling in favors, covering it up, using his political leverage to protect his son from this crime. And it's not like Breaking Bad, where, like, I could still kind of, like, root for Walt in the sense that, like, he's just entertaining to watch on screen. This just made me feel really dirty at the end of it. And yeah, like there's no good characters.
And then several seasons, I don't know how many in, he goes on a vision quest up the mountain, and they put him in, you know, they surround him with flags and a bison skull, and he's going on his vision quest. Because not because he's native or because he has any redeeming qualities about him, but because he has, Monty, you're going to love this. Because he has seen a wolf who has been hanging out near his house.
No, that's like early in the season, his son sees a wolf, right? Like after the sweat or whatever.
And that, I did, oh God, that was a palm to the face, kind of like, what the, you know? And the native characters are, again, cardboard.
Murder dolls.
Yeah.
Yep. They're just there to be murdered, whatever, played with, tortured, and traumatized, you know, whatever.
And outsmarted, outfinanced, you know.
Oh, can we talk about the rich one? The rich indigenous man? Oh my goodness. That's like reverse annihilation theory embodied. Literally, first episode, he's like, I'm going to buy it all back, which I'm like, okay, whatever. That's like, you know, Nick Tilson's plan or whatever. An Indian collector. You know, whatever. No shade, no shade. Love you guys. Anyway. You know, like.
Ended forever.
You know, like, whatever, you know, I'm okay with it. But then by the third episode, he's like, I'll erase your family from history. That's just like, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a big turn.
Just like every character in this show is just like a walking trope, you know? Yeah. You have the gruff, capable white patriarch who is beset on all sides by intruders onto his land, which... like,
oh yeah, can we
talk
about the paranoia?
The built-in irony of that.
It's like
justifies the paranoia. Well, and like that is one of the core themes of the whole Yellowstone show. It's about a way of life that is dying, you know. It's the trope of like the dying Indians and the conservative, the right-wing conservative fear of being encroached upon by modernity and by these scary brown people who want to take away your land. And it's so baked into the bones of the show that it's completely inescapable. And it's on the surface, it seems like Sheridan's trying to say something about that, but he never does. Like, he never provides any answers to those questions about, like, well, like, John Dutton is trying to protect his ranch land, you know, this a ranch the size of Rhode Island, but like he can't see the irony of that, where he's trying to protect that from the indigenous peoples who are encroaching on his land. Like, there's that, it's this conflict that is presented but never expanded upon. And four seasons in, if it hasn't answered those questions by now, it seems like Sheridan's not even interested in looking at that.
Whoa, you go four seasons without any of like answers to like the first season drama?
Well, and they never acknowledge in any way that what you're saying, Parker, absolutely, that the fact that out of all of John Dutton's kids, we know that Beth cannot have children, and Casey is married to an indigenous woman. So the only grandchild that John Dutton has is an indigenous kid. So he's protecting all of this land, which will ultimately probably go to this indigenous kid.
So it just comes back to us anyway. Like, that's...
well, like, and ironic. That's the thing. Like, he tries to become a part of his grandchild's life, and that's a struggle because
what season Casey, does that get to? That sounds interesting, actually.
Like in the later seasons, in the first season, the main conflict is him trying to reconnect with Casey, because Casey is like the sort of black sheep of the family, because he lives on the reservation with his wife, like he's gone native, you know, like it's that whole trope.
I figured that's where they were going with him. I'm going to join the military. No, I'm going to become native.
They're the same thing.
Yeah, sure. Well, except one's a legalized serial killer, right? He murders a bunch of people. Then he's like, I'm going to go back to the Middle East to murder people.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And if he goes back to the res, I bet you he murders more people there too.
He just does. Saying. He murders a lot of people.
Well, like that drug, well, the supposed drug lab explosion. Is that actually a drug lab? I guess like I wasn't paying enough attention. I just noticed that he's putting out a guy in... putting him out of his misery, and then the cop shows up and is like, oh, I'll just take your gun. See ya. Get out of here. The tribal police, the chief, just get out of here. I believe you.
Right. Yeah. Like that was, that was a whole nother thing too. Just like the writing keeps putting him into these situations where like he just keeps committing violence against the indigenous people. And it's like, Sheridan, what are you trying to say?
And he's a wildlife inspector. I mean, that is his, not wildlife, livestock. I'm sorry. He's a livestock inspector or protector, whatever it is. That gives him the right to carry a gun and to enforce livestock rules, laws, whatever livestock laws are. And like, he seems to have carte blanche to like kill everybody and anybody he feels like it, because he has this badge that says he's a cow guardian. You know, it's like
cow guardian.
I like that. India. They should have that written on their vests instead of livestock officer, cow guardian. Cow
guardian.
Guardians of the cow nation. That's a joke, actually. There's this right-wing militia called Guardians of the Oglala Nation that used to terrorize AIM.
The Goon Squad.
Yeah, back in the 70s, for listeners uninitiated to this history. But yeah.
Vicky Wilson's.
Yeah, well, and honestly, who is it? The rich dude, I forget his name, I can't think of it. But the rich indigenous man, he honestly has like a Dick Wilson vibe to him, minus that he's trying to get land back instead of like sell it off, you know.
Yeah, he dresses better.
He dresses way better.
And he doesn't, his squad doesn't ride around in the back of pickup trucks with rifles, but he basically is that same character, just a little bit more modern.
Well, I feel like, you know, yeah, exactly. It's the way I described it. You were saying something. I have two notebooks. This is a bad idea. But you mentioned, where is it? Oh, yeah. So settler nostalgia, right? And, you know, why are all these cowboy movies being made again? Like Magnificent Seven with like Chris Pratt and like Samuel Jackson or whatever. You know, a lot of big name movie stars taking up Westerns again. You know, so a lot of the Westerns, thank goodness, didn't, you know, feature an indigenous person getting murdered. That's the smart thing to do nowadays if you're going to do a Western, you know, like you shouldn't kill them. That's doesn't look good. Just saying, you know, make the bad guys the gold, you know, miners. You know, be smart about this. But the right wingers are the ones doing this, right? So they're trying to make a argument for justified violence, right? There's a reason we need our guns around the reservation, so that way we can uphold justice, like preventing cattle wrestling. It's such a huge problem. It's not. They let their fucking cows get loose. They wander off into some Indian's land, and then they accuse them of fucking stealing it and shit like that all the time. All the fucking time. It's super, at least on my reservation. I don't know how it is on other reservations, but I've seen some mad bullshit. Sorry. This topic makes me mad. Ranchers are not my friend, and I hate Kevin Costner. So I'm coming from this from the Costnerverse, not the Sheridan media empire.
Yeah,
they're the same thing. One's behind the camera, one's in front of it. They're the same person.
Mm-hmm. Both are this. I called them in my notes. Their mind's like the, you know, Indian in the cabinet, right? And like they keep putting these dolls in there with like no life to them whatsoever, besides to be played with in this kid's imagination of what settler colonialism means from the white perspective. And it ends up being a fetishization of, you know, well, like in Indian in the cupboard, you know, you have like Darth Vader included in the movie, at least, you know, but you do have a lot more character development towards the cowboy, you know, overcoming his hatred of the Indian. But even then, you know, this is a story about white people, right? And so then you have this story, right, which is a story about this white patriarchal family that wants to maintain their little, you know, hamlet that's basically their own feudal like land where they brand each other and fucking
what the fuck is that. So I kind of want to talk about that for a bit.
What did y'all make me watch?
Yeah.
Wild stuff. I thought Costner's movies were bad. I watched Waterworld before starting this marathon. I was like, yeah, Costner's film. You know? And I was like, this is a propaganda movie too. So that's my conclusion, is he works with propagandists. Because what he tried to do in the 70s was he tried to present himself as a native and push a right-wing narrative for the longest time till he got outed around the time like Ward Churchill gets outed and stuff. So it's like
Kevin Costner is an op.
I think so.
Kevin Costner is Ward Churchill with plastic surgery.
Yes. Ooh. But he wears a suit. But I feel like, you know, this classic, you know, paranoid story of the Indians always going to invade. We have to kill them first before they kill us is really the original QAnon. That was sort of the thesis I came to while watching this and discovering these connections, is that you have these stories based in fantasy. I mean, absolute. First off, the idealization of mobs. I see this in leftist circles. There's literally a leftist watch group that I'm friends with that watches The Sopranos and critiques it. It's a lot of, you know, pissing on it, but like, you know, they hate watch it like I watch Costner because they're Italian. So I'm just like, okay, this is interesting to hear about, whatever. Tell me about it. I'm never going to waste my time, you know?
And the other interesting thing, if you look, and you have to really watch pretty much the whole series to get this, but anytime you see the native characters, they're usually dressed in, suits, ties, and they're in their offices, or they're visiting with their lawyer, or they're making, you know, boardroom deals. But when you see the white characters, particularly the Duttons, they're part of the landscape. So they are shot as like they belong in this landscape, whereas the native characters are always decontextualized. And it started to change in later seasons, but like the camping scenes are all the Duttons and the grandchild, but they're all the white people.
Okay, well, do they ever have like this noble savage moment of like the grandson becoming Indian? You know, he just connects with the nature somewhere, like flute music plays behind. Yeah,
he does have the wolf experience.
No, yeah. I'm just saying, like, this is the classic tropes, right? I haven't watched past season one, you know, and I barely watch, you know, I'm writing notes and reading books while it's playing in the background. I'm like, oh, that's a weird sentence to hear. I'll remove your family from history. The native said that, the same guy with the I'm going to buy back land for land back plan. He's the one who's going to remove him from history. Like, because what that's doing is it's presenting even the liberal options for land back, which buying back the land, whatever, sure. At least we get the land back in the end. If that's what every other Indian ends up deciding, I'm not a fan of it. I'm a much more radical person. I'm like, it's our land already. Why would we pay for it again? You know, that's my mentality.
Well, and why would we put a ski area and an airport in it in order to buy it back?
Because it's fun.
Yeah.
No, well, that actually reminds me, like, you know, the first time Marcella Gilbert goes skiing, I think, was in the Alps when they go to the UN conference. You know, like, from, you know, South Dakota, you could go to the mountains of Montana, right, theoretically. But the first time you're going skiing is at a UN summit. Cool. That's a cool story. Casual.
Yeah, so I really did want to go back to the
branding.
Yeah.
Branding.
Because I found that very, like, very indicative of just like the whole thesis of Yellowstone in a nutshell. Like I said earlier, what John Dutton is doing is trying to protect his little slice of land, his little slice of heaven as he sees it. And by extension, he's trying to protect the way of life that he believes should be lived. We see that process from the first episode in the character of Jimmy. He's the trailer park drug addict who Rip, John Dutton's right hand man and fixer. He goes to Jimmy's trailer and says like what do you want to do? Do you want to be in jail or do you want to work for us? And so there's this ultimatum given, and so he gets branded and then brought on the ranch to work as a ranch hand. And over the course of the show, Jimmy is further and further drawn into the lifestyle that the Duttons are trying to preserve. He starts dressing more like a cowboy. He's hanging out in the bunkhouse with the other ranch hands. He's a sort of fish out of water at first, but then he slowly starts to become more and more accepted with the group. And that's kind of what I saw as the brand. It's a way to absorb somebody into your own way of life, you know, which we see in history throughout the white settler colonialism, you know, erasing indigenous culture, making people more like the white man, and you should live in the city and work in an office, like you were saying, Elena, instead of being a part of the land. And the fact that you brand cattle to mark them as your property. So you're making your ranch hands your own property, which is already a whole nother can of worms. So yeah, that brand thing has a whole lot of stuff involved with it.
Well, it's predatory to target criminals, right? In this attempt to say, oh, would you rather be in jail or branded in my essentially slave? Let's be exactly. honest about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This would be slavery. Even if you're getting a wage, if they've branded you, I'm sorry, but that is an open air prison.
It is. And you don't get to leave. You can be killed and thrown down in that gulch, mm-hmm. that, you know, or you can earn the respect of John Dutton, who will then allow you to go to another ranch and work for his buddies. But it's all couched in the guise of John Dutton was friends with Jimmy's grandfather and feels a debt. So that debt is that he will take on Jimmy, but he will brand him and make him a slave or indentured servant to Yellowstone. And he's only allowed to leave because he gets knocked the crap out of him on a horse and is basically pretty much paralyzed for a while. He does get better. But then Dutton sends him one of them sends him down to Texas to learn how to be a real man. Mm-hmm. Because with Taylor Sheridan, Texas is where real men come from, and
Sheridan came from.
That's where you have to learn to be a cowboy. You're not really a cowboy unless you come from Texas.
Yes. So unless y'all have other stuff to mention about Yellowstone, I wanted to make sure that we went a bit more in depth about 1883 as well. Because that is the mark of where Sheridan is really trying to make this extended Sheridan universe. There's this prequel, which gets some setup mentions in season 4 because 1883 was about to come out. We have another one that's releasing called 1923 with Harrison Ford.
And Helen Mirren.
And Helen Mirren. Yeah, a weird combo. And
Harrison Ford is that, you know, male lead animal magnetism to this day.
Well, I mean, like, he's 80 just
years old.
That's yeah, Han but Solo.
Yeah, but he plays a gruff white man. He plays a gruff white man, which really fits within the Yellowstone universe. Well, yeah, essentially. Like, he's played the same character for the past like 40 years. Yeah.
He should be in Blade Runner. What about Renegade Scavenger running from the Imperial force he left? Huh? Oh, okay.
On a horse.
Yeah,
on a horse instead of the freaking Millennium. Please tell me it's called the Falcon, his horse.
Oh God. Yeah. So, speaking about the casting, like 1883 filled with country music stars and, like Tim McGraw, who's our main character, his wife
Faith
in
Hill,
the movie,
yeah.
Faith Hill, real life wife. And
I didn't know that was Tim McGraw.
Yeah, it's so explicitly playing towards its very obvious conservative older.
Well, and also Duck Dynasty audience. In Yellowstone, right?
Yeah. So I looked that up. I couldn't find out what you meant when you said.
Oh, it was like one of the ranch hands or something. Like there was like a cameo or something of a Duck Dynasty son. The blonde one, I don't know.
Would not surprise me, but yeah.
I was like, no way. Are you freaking kidding? I was listening to this European dude who was like, and Duck Dynasty guy over here. And I was like, that guy's from Duck Dynasty. He kind of looks like it. I could see it. But maybe he was just making a joke. I don't know.
I feel like he might have just been making a joke.
Yeah, yeah.
Just about but the like, appearance.
You know, if somebody looks like they're from Duck Dynasty and you tell me they're from Duck Dynasty, I'm going to be like, that dude's from Duck Dynasty.
Right, yeah. I mean, like, I would believe it, like, outright as well.
Are. I just know they're liars, right? Like, they're actually, like, city boys, but, like, from California and stuff like that. That just
right,
made
yeah.
this right-wing persona like Teddy Roosevelt did back in the day. Which, yeah. mind you, there's archive photos of him posing with scalps. So, like,
yeah,
that's what a frontiersman is. It's a scalper. It's somebody who makes $20 per scalp.
Jesus,
like, fuck. And that's back in the day. That's like $800 a scalp today. You know how much? That's a lot of money. For a poor person, $800.
Yeah. Oh God,
that's horrible.
Yeah. So 1883, it does go back to that more traditional Western of like the six shooters and Sam Elliott with his handlebar mustache.
Oh, yes. You got to have
but
Sam
it's also
Elliott
it's also yeah. Dances with Wolves. I mean, it's a guy
yeah.
who
mm-hmm.
who is seriously damaged by the Civil War. And it's a white guy. He's so badly damaged by his experiences in the Civil War that he wants to get as far away from quote unquote civilization as he can. So he heads west with his daughter and his son and his wife and his sister. And you don't even like she's there and then she's dead with her kids. So they're all heading west and it sets up, you know, immediately. Like if Yellowstone is civilization, then 1883 is how the white man conquered it
yeah.
and made conquered the wilderness, tamed the West and made it into this civilization that is Yellowstone. And it's a very oppositional, immediately there's an oppositional relationship between every single group of characters and the land. So the land is the enemy. And the trail is the enemy, and everything out there will kill you. And I think Elsa actually says that at one point.
Mm-hmm.
Everything out here will kill you.
Yeah,
and
yeah, that's the monologue. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the natives will kill you, the tornadoes will kill you, the snakes will kill you. I mean, it's everything will kill you. And so they have to conquer this in order to get to the point where they can establish this Yellowstone dynasty. And it's Dances with Wolves rewritten, and there's the
made longer
Indians, made into a whole series. There's there's good Indians and there's bad Indians, and then Elsa, of course, hooks up with one of them, and they become a couple, and then at the very end, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't finished 1883, Elsa dies, and she is shot by the bad Indians with arrows, and so this virgin landscape that was Elsa, and this wonderment that you're supposed to get from her and her monologues, that this not only will everything kill you, but it's the most beautiful place on earth, and this is the only place she's found that she can be free. And so she hooks up with this Indian guy, and he gives her this whole outfit. So she's now a white young woman dressed in not Native women, but Native man's clothes, and she ultimately ends up dead. And her father, they're on the trail, and her father ends up leading a whole bunch of stragglers from God A to B, and they happen upon our near and dear to my heart, Graham Greene, playing this pathetic little role. Who says, and Tim McGraw is carrying Elsa, and he's like, I need to go find a place to settle so that we want to take her where we're going to ultimately settle. So, here's Graham Greene. We've come to steal your land, and my daughter's dying. So yes. We need to find a place where we can bury her and then claim all this land for ourselves. Are you cool with that? And he says, yeah. So go
with this one dude.
Yeah.
Along the way on the trail, it's just like what's it called? Holy Grail story, right? Like you got to answer the questions. You let them go. What the fuck?
Yeah.
And so he points them in this, he says, yes, over this hill, along this river, whatever is where, you should take her. And I forget exactly what the dialogue is, but it's clear that this is a place that's important to Graham Greene and his people. And he says, and this is going to be telling in upcoming seasons, episodes, series, I don't know what. If we come there sometime looking to hunt, you'll let us, right? Oh, and Tim McGraw says, yes. And so he goes with his dying daughter and sets up under a tree. And that's the end of 1883. That's it. And so you can speculate based on where Yellowstone is chronologically, and then this 1933, 23, whatever, that those were the great grandparents, and then the son will be at some number of parents back from John Dutton, and that this is this mythology of how they came to own all of this land that becomes the Yellowstone. But it's just given to them by Graham Greene.
It really comes across as a series of myth making, of mythologizing, of trying to make white settlers of today feel better about their circumstances because this is what their ancestors went through. These were the tough times that they went through. So I deserve to be here because I came from that. And like you said, it's establishing this lineage of this mythological Dutton all-American family. You mentioned that Tim McGraw's character, James, was a Civil War soldier trying to get away from all of that. I want to make sure that we touch on the fact that he was a Confederate soldier.
Whoa!
Yeah.
Well, yeah, he was from Tennessee.
Yep. So So we got the whole noble Confederate trope over here. Yeah, I could not believe that they went that route.
Well, so what's messed up is, like, I often say that the way the North and the South reunited after, you know, everything was by murdering us. You know, we blew them back together. And so, like, this is just, like, the embodiment of settler colonialism. I think in my notes I put settler colonialism and the contradictions of monopoly capitalism. Yeah, you know, that's the perfect summary.
Right.
Regeneration of the Union through violence, and you know, that's the way this country has always, you know, when something is going bad, when the economy is tanking, what do? You declare war. Well, here you had a war, and everything was fucked. So what did you do? You got those soldiers together, and North and South, and you went and murdered Indians and. Mm. Yep, exactly.
Yeah. So there's that character background, and then Sam Elliott's character, Shay, and oh my gosh, I cannot remember his actor's name. I'll look it up now. But the actor who plays his partner, Thomas, they are both Pinkerton agents. LaMonica Garrett is the actor's name. Yeah. Yeah. Pinkerton.
They're the early feds.
Yeah. And so these are our protagonists. Two Pinkerton agents and a Confederate soldier.
Ward Churchill would hate this series because of that. He loves the Confederacy. I'm just saying, I have a whole interview with him where he spends like an hour talking about how it's the War of Northern Aggression.
Oh, God. Yeah. So... yeah, there's that. Shay's whole tortured background is that he lost his wife and daughter to smallpox, and he's just, like, he's barely living one day at a time. Thomas's character, he's just trying to find a place where he belongs. He ends up getting together with a Romani character, actually. They end the show settling in Oregon, which I found interesting because around this time, black people straight up just weren't allowed in Oregon.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, anyone could just, you know, try their best to just ignore that and maybe find their own spot where they can still live there. But like that's not mentioned at all. Like, that's not like... A potential conflict, like, hey, Thomas, you know about the circumstance in Oregon, right? Like, are you going to be okay about it? Like, it seems like they're just trying to set up these character backgrounds to seem colorful and interesting, but they don't actually delve into what that means. Like, what did it mean to be a Pinkerton agent in 1883? What did it mean to be a Confederate veteran in 1883? Like, they can't just be, like, a line item on their backstory sheet. Like, you have to actually explore that, but they never do.
Well, were there really any black Pinkerton agents in 1883?
That's another thing, yeah.
Yeah, that was a question
slaves.
I had.
You know, like...
Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah, so, and casting...
I was going to say the Sam Elliott character. So you see, you know, the end, like... the you know, the despair of losing Elsa, but they have found, the Duttons have found their legacy home. And then you get what was his name, the Pinkerton character who marries their, who hooks up with the Romani.
His name was Thomas. Yeah.
Thomas. So then Thomas and his woman go to Oregon, and you get this idea, you see her kids, she has kids running around. And so they have found their place in the sun. And poor old Sam Elliott, he gets to the Pacific Ocean and he shoots himself in the head. So like that was the end of him. Because he his wife wanted to see the ocean and he saw it for her, and then he killed himself.
Yeah. I figured that's where his character was going to end, because like in like the first 5 minutes, like he's just kind of sitting in a field with a gun to his chin and he's about to do it, but then Thomas is like, hey, man, we got to go. If you're going to do this, do it. But like, we got to go. And he's like, all right, fine, I'll get back. And yeah, a lot of 1883 really just seemed like the whole like violence and despair porn, like you were saying earlier. Like,
that's
just
like Dances with Wolves too, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because like, it starts out with Dunbar. It's not even that. They don't even change the names that much.
Oh my God.
He really rode in front of all of those soldiers trying to kill himself. That like was like murder by soldier. And that's how Dances with Wolves begins.
And then the guy kills himself off screen at the very beginning too, right? Yep. And then like you find his love interest and she's slicing her wrist.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, Taylor Sheridan is like, he's a bloodbath. I mean,
well,
that's all
he
is. Seller
pathology, I feel like. You know what I mean? Like, if you're talking about these stories, it has to be the only way you can sympathize with the settler is by this violence porn. It's the same way that what's his face used so much blood in Passion of the Christ.
Mel Gibson.
The anti-Semites, how I know. Oh, Patriot. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The Patriot is. Yeah. Violence is the only way that you can solve your problems here. Like, that's how the Duttons defend their ranch. That's how 1883 drives its conflict. That's just how Taylor Sheridan has really made his bread and butter with in all of his writing. And especially, I want to make sure we touch on violence against women, and especially indigenous women. Like you mentioned, Wind River is probably the worst example of this in his writing, with that the general conceit of the movie about finding out what happened to this murdered indigenous woman, and then that graphic sexual assault scene near the end, and like that's also just a continuing theme throughout Yellowstone, 1883. So I was curious to hear y'all's thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean the porn in that Wind River scene was just it was impossible to watch. And then the replaying over and over again of her running through and you know, like through a Montana winter night with very little clothes on and no shoes. And the way they describe her as how brave she was, that she was running and she almost made it. It was really disgusting the way that was framed. And you knew her death was the only thing that brought all these people together. So the journey for these male characters was all about her death. So in order for them to find some closure or some sense of closure, you have to relive this death. You know, what happened to this girl with the vicious sexual assault, but also running, constantly seeing her running, you know, through the cold. And there's also this episode or two episodes where Casey's wife, and I can't even remember her name, I hate to say it, but Casey's wife in Yellowstone is tagged to be the bait for this serial killer so this is a theme again of missing and murdered indigenous women. So she has agreed to be the bait to catch this guy that they think has been kidnapping and God knows what with these native women. And you see it, this is another hugely graphic and pornographic scene where you actually see her having to fight to get away from him because she gets into his car willingly. And you see her running. And there's like this running across the field until the tribal cops suddenly appear and save her. And so you're constantly being barraged with these images of violence against Native women. And they seem to be completely victims. Like they're running, they're not fighting back, as opposed completely to Beth Dutton, who seems to always be fighting. Like she's pulling guns on people and she's threatening her brother, and she's like this strong female character, but she's totally defined. Like her character never acts, her character only reacts. And she reacts to her father, and she reacts to what her brother has done, and she reacts to all of this. And so she's never defined by herself. And the indigenous characters are the same. They're never defined by themselves. They're always defined by the male characters and their reflections of the male characters and what the male characters represent.
Yes. The theme of in Wind River, like you were saying, of how all the characters kept saying that she was so brave, so strong, and with Beth, she acts, quote unquote, like the male members of her family, because she is that one woman in this patriarchal family. So she has to act like a man, she has to act strong. Like they're all defined by the traditionally male characteristics, and Sheridan tries to like make it seem like a compliment, like these women are admirable because they are brave and strong, because they act like men. Not to say that women can't be brave or strong or anything, but like it is a running theme that you see throughout his work. It's like just he makes it seem like that's the only way that they can exist in this world that he's created.
Well, they have no redeeming qualities at all. I mean, Beth Dutton to me is completely unlikable.
Well, like massive asshole. Should I like these characters? Like, I'm wondering if like later on in the series they get better. You know, like a Jamie from Game of Thrones situation, you know?
Yeah, like in the first episode, Casey was like the most sympathetic character, and then he executed his wife's brother. And, right,
that's
and so I was like, okay, well, then I guess I'm not supposed to like anybody in the show.
No, I don't think any of them are likable.
Yeah.
No redeeming quality. I get it's supposed to be like grungy, but like you're supposed to like have something. Like I wish there was something I could offer. Like, besides Kevin Costner's only good movie is Waterworld, because that's not a good movie. You know, like...
Yeah.
The first time I actually saw this was in the psych ward, so, like, that's my relationship to this. I'm just like, I hate this.
It's kind of apropos. Yeah, I don't like any of them. I don't like any of the male characters, and I don't like any of the women. Like,
I was actually going to say on the MMIW stuff, speaking of the women, it reminded me a lot of the anime Aquash story, actually, and how the FBI tries to betray it with her daughter. Sorry for interrupting. But.
Yeah. No, that's right.
Well, and like I believe a lot of the Twitter conversation, because it was 2017 about when that came out, and a lot of the conversation online was... Well, and even like now blogs talking about the movie and anime Aquash make reference to it. And like, you know, you also have DAPL going on around there. It makes a lot of sense to create a politicized movie that people can draw on in their analysis, you know, to better interpret the events, right? And if it's, you know, a right-wing murder porn fantasy like this, what a great source for them, you know, like not really, but like, you know, in terms of if you're a propagandist trying to spin something up.
And I think that's exactly what he's trying to do. I mean, he clearly knows of the issue of missing and murdered indigenous women, because he references it, but he references it in such a backhanded way that, yes, in Wind River, there were extractive industries, there were man camps. And so he's putting the blame squarely where it belongs without ever analyzing it, without ever, you know, taking a deep dive into it. And then he, you know, he ties that all up with a lovely ribbon by, you know, this very pornographic scene. And in Yellowstone, it's the same thing. Like, you don't ever really hear anything substantive about the issues of these women going missing, but you do have Casey's wife, and I can't remember her name. Anyway,
Monica, I believe.
Actually. Monica.
Yeah.
She's problematic to me on a number of levels. Number one is that she's not Indigenous and she's pretending to be Indigenous.
Yes.
And she's actually half Asian, and people have called her out on that and nobody seems to care. But so she sets herself up as bait to try to catch this guy. And you feel like maybe there is something about her that is admirable, and yet I just find her whiny and kind of weak-willed, and I just don't find her to be a strong character.
What's her response to the news her brother got murdered by her husband?
Yeah.
Is there ever a response? Because, like, that's, like, fucked. Well, and not to mention, freaking Rip or whatever, the white dad or whatever, going, you're going to have to choose your kind one day. And then, like, freaking,
yeah,
literally go and murder the Indian right after that. Are you kidding me?
Uh-huh.
That's like the grocery store shooter who was like, we don't kill our own kind. And then the one guy with a gun at the grocery store was like, oh, okay, I'll just go home. That literally happened, by the way, if you didn't remember, but that literally happened.
Yeah.
It's like we see that in 1883 with Elsa hooking up with that one. I believe he was Comanche. His name was Sam. And like, obviously, her parents disapprove, you know, like that's not being a good white woman. And we see that with Casey. He's seen as almost like the traitor of the family because he's left the ranch to go live on the reservation. Yeah, like it's definitely not the greatest.
Well, and then he comes back to live in the big house, and
yeah.
And then people come and massacre his entire family, and well, not his entire family, and they don't massacre him because, okay, you know, yeah, John Dutton lives.
But I was gonna say,
the kid is so traumatized that they move back to the res, and that's when he starts seeing the wolf, and that's what leads to his vision quest, and yeah, it's such a mishmash of fucked up stuff.
I want to see Kevin Costner in a scene with somebody yelling out this kid's native name to him, right? Like it's two families running after him, right? He's gonna have to choose a side. Which path will he take? Who is his kind, right? That's the turmoil they're setting up later seasons, I bet.
Yeah.
And freaking, he's gonna be like, I bet you they'll have Costner yell out the name. And then they'll choose the white dad, and it'll be like, well, white grandpa or whatever, and be like, oh, you're the best.
The way it should end is that he should inherit everything, and then he should give it back to the tribe, right?
Well, that's why he has to choose Costner.
But you know that's not going to happen.
No, I bet you it does, because he'll choose Costner, right? Making Costner think this Indian chose to be white. But just like Floyd Westerman said in his famous song that he, you know, did a cover of Johnny Cash doing a cover of another Native song. But in that song, it goes, in 500 years of fighting, not one Indian turned white. And this is going to be another example. That's what my hope is. Hopefully they'll see this like podcast and be like, oh, that's a good idea. Write that down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Taylor me. Sheridan, if you're listening.
Sheridan, uh-huh. I'll work for you. You just got to pay me a lot.
Forget okay? all that bad stuff we said about you. We've got
right, yeah.
the idea for you.
No. Remember it. Remember it and pay me more.
All right. Well, I do apologize for putting you both through the torture of watching this Sheridan multiverse horrible ecosystem of media. But
fun.
Yeah,
I never knew about these guys really
yeah.
in depth, and now I've learned way too much.
Exactly. Yeah, that's how all this always turns out. Like, whenever I choose to do an episode on something, I go way too deep.
You're overcritical? And
I do. I go overcritical. Yeah. You tied that back in. Thank you. Thank you. Beautiful.
Just a bit overcritical. Title
wrong. Well, yeah. Yeah, so thank you both again for coming on the show. I think that's a good place to end it. Where can my small audience find you guys and what y'all do?
So redmedia.org is our media company, and the rednation.org is our activist organization, and you can find Shumanitu's got another podcast,
Bands of Turtle Island, if you want to hear more of my wildness. Or you can subscribe for $1 a month to our Patreon, which is Red Media Press, I believe, or Red Media PR. I should have
Red Media
that
PR,
up.
Yeah,
Red Media PR, and you can get access to a bunch of bonus content. Where, like, I'll tell you how, like, Ancient Aliens was actually written by the Nazis. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Weird stuff. You go down these rabbit holes and you find some weird stuff.
Like it's actually good content.
Fast Time at Ridgemont High money paid for Yellowstone. Okay. Fast Times at Ridgemont High paid for
the spider web movie. Keeps expanding. Oh my lord.
It's so stupid. The guy who helped produce that basically made Costner's career, and then got his son to basically hook Costner up with the job with his, like, right wing friends. It's a crazy story how Costner
Holy
got involved.
Shit.
Yeah, wild shit.
Well, yeah. So look at Bands of Turtle Island for more of wild shit like that.
Okay. Oh, and then at Bands Island on Twitter, and then like Zicada's Tin Can on Patreon if you want to support that stupid research.
Yes. And my personal favorite, Red Media Power Hour.
Red Power Hour and the Red Nation podcast. Yep.
Yes. Yeah. Love those two. Y'all's Avatar episode is the one that I most recently listened to. Really great, really great analysis on that.
I'm so sad I missed that episode. It's so good.
You were sick, I think. Oh my God.
Yeah, I was having issues, but yeah.
Again. Yeah, but the next one's coming out. So.
Oh yeah, I'll be on the next one. Oh my goodness. Yep. I'm guessing it's gonna be a big mini Wachoni episode, right? Like they're gonna steal so much from the Water is Life theme, and it's gonna be chef's kiss.
Chef's kiss. Looking forward to it. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks, Elena Shungmanitu, yes, thank you for coming on the show. Great to speak with you. This has been Overcritical, and I will see y'all next time. If you like the show, please leave a review. It helps me out a lot and lets me know what I can improve or what I should keep doing. If you want to follow me on social media, you can follow me at Tall Leftist or Overcritical Pod on Twitter or on Instagram at Overcritical Podcast. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see y'all next time.